This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 19th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm very pleased to have with me Mikko Hyponen, whose name I'm sure I butchered. How do you actually say your last name?
Good to hear from you, Gary. My name is Mikko Hyponen. So it's a very long K and very long P, but that's the way Finnish names are.
So Mikko is the Chief Research Officer for F-Secure, where he's worked since 1991. An active malicious code researcher, Mikko and his team have done prominent work against the SoBig.F worm in 2003 and Sasser and Zotab. They've also been active in the discovery of malicious code used for good, and I use that in quotes, such as Sony's infamous DRM rootkit. Mikko collects and restores arcade video games and game consoles, and he lives with his family on the island of Oulu, in Finland. Now, how do you actually say the island's name?
Well, actually, that's not even the right island. It's close by. It's actually close to Helsinki. So it is an island, but it's not like in the middle of wilderness or anything like that.
Well, let's get started. So your company is based in Helsinki.
Yeah, well, that's where we started in 1988. But of course, the company's grown, and I'd like to think it as a pretty global company. And nowadays, we have offices in 18 countries, but most of our geeks and nerds are right here in Helsinki, where I am right now.
So what are the challenges and advantages of the location? You know, when you're running a high-tech company, what's good and what's bad about being in Helsinki?
Well, there's lots of things that work to your advantages, and there are things that don't really help. Of course, you have a home market, which Europeans like to buy from European companies. That's an advantage. But of course, the big markets are, of course, run by the big brands, and it's really hard to build a big and strong brand when you're coming from a smaller country. There are advantages like time zones. You know, we are 7 hours ahead of you guys, and you're on the East Coast, which means when big things start to happen, like a virus outbreak, we typically get to analyze it for a few, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours before our competitors in U.S. wake up, which is a nice thing for us. So I guess it works both ways.
Mm-hmm. So you became well known for your work on worms, like the SoBig worm and Sasser and others. Why are worms no longer making the news?
Because worms are not really the right tool for you if you want to become rich by writing malware. Worms are worms because they spread on their own. You know, they have their own mind, which means they get out of hand. And if you think about the big Windows worm outbreaks, things like Sasser and I Love You Worm or Melissa and Slammer and Blaster and what have you, they all became such big news because they got out of hand, they got out of control, and they infected way too many machines to stay undetectable or to stay unnoticed. In fact, it can be argued that the motive of the hobbyists who wrote these early worms, their motive was to become famous, and their motive was to get on the front page of the New York Times, and they all got it. But today, as you know, and as is well understood, the malware authors have changed almost totally from the good old hobbyists and teenage kids to professionals who do this for money.
So do you think the professionals are using worm technology? Are they using phishing? Are same techniques, but done in a much stealthier and smarter manner?
Or actually, I would say in a more controlled manner. So the techniques are very similar, just the same ideas like email spreading mechanisms like we've seen for, well, since 1998, 1999, when Windows email worm started spreading. The difference is when a traditional email worm would infect your PC and immediately locate your address book and send gazillion copies of itself to every single one listed in your address books, modern bots and modern Trojans infect your PC and then wait for instructions.
Right.
And they will do the same thing, spread further from your machine, only when told to. And
right.
They're only told to in nicely controlled fashion. So the guys who orchestrate this all and the botnet herders only infect, you know, a handful, like a few thousand PCs a day. And that stays nicely under horizon. Nobody pays attention. It doesn't make big headlines, but they still get what they want.
Yeah, very good. So one of the ways of building your botnet is to use a much stealthier worm.
Absolutely.
Yep. So some whining people have complained that your work on mobile security, that is cell phone malware and protection against cell phone malware, hypes up a problem that doesn't exist. I don't believe that myself, but some people have said that. And yet, real malicious code like the caber worm does exist, and it presents a risk that's well worth understanding. Do you think that this confusion is because the U.S. is behind on cell technology and adoption?
Yeah, I guess there's quite often surprised faces and more questions about mobile threats and mobile security when I speak about these things in USA. Much more than in Europe or in Asia, where many people have seen these for themselves, and things like smartphones have been commonplace for much longer. I mean, pretty much the only smartphones you could actually see in the hands of people in U.S. before iPhone were BlackBerries, which are quite different from the kinds of smartphones and communicators people have been using for many, many years in Asia and Japan, and to some extent as well over here in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
As an example, I've genuinely received to my own personal phone a mobile phone virus four times so far. Once in Sweden and twice here in Finland. And
which
these
worm
were all
was
variants
it?
Of the Kabir or the Comvarior worms.
Right.
Of course, I have an antivirus on my phone or in my smartphone, so nothing ever happened. And of course, I do keep my Bluetooth on and visible just for this purpose, so I can keep monitoring what's going on out there. But I wasn't inviting anything. Somebody, one of these things was beamed to my phone from a bus passing by car. I was standing next to a car at the red light, and that car apparently had an infected phone somewhere inside, and that was beaming a virus to my phone. So it is a problem which does exist. We have been following it since we found the very first mobile phone virus in the summer of 2004. Right now, the total count of all mobile phone malware, which by the way includes malware for BlackBerries,
mm-hmm.
is getting closer to 400, which is a number, but it's of course far, far away from the number of all PC malware, which is, you know, around 1,000 times more, 400,000.
Sure. Well, you gave a great talk on that at USENIX Security. Thanks for that again.
Sure, absolutely. Well, and thanks for being part to invite me, Gary.
Absolutely. So what do you think we can expect for the future when it comes to malicious code on mobile devices? Are there any interesting things that are happening in that space that people
absolutely
need to be aware of?
Absolutely. There's many things happening. Let me just, for example, one thing which is the obvious difference between infecting computers and infecting phones is that computers don't have a built-in billing mechanism which would be standard and which exists on every single device, but phones do. Mm-hmm. If you make a phone call, that's a transaction. That moves money. If you call a premium rate number, like, what do you call them, 1-800 numbers?
900 numbers.
Okay, 1-900 numbers. That's a transaction which costs more money, and there's actually money being moved between individuals then. If a phone gets infected, for example, if your iPhone gets infected by some Trojan which can control the device, it can make phone calls or it can send text messages to premium rate numbers and move money from your account to somebody else's account. And this has, by the way, happened. We have seen some documented cases where this has actually happened for real. Last May, for example, we found a Trojan which was distributed on mobile phone freeware, shareware download site where people could download applications for their phones. One of those applications claimed to be a tool which will speed up your web surfing on your phone for Symbian-based devices, for example, phones made by Nokia or Sony Ericsson.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it didn't do that at all. Instead, it started sending these premium rate text messages, and it would send a $5 message every 5 minutes or something along those lines. So it does add up.
Are these things becoming stealthy a la rootkits in some of the ways that botnets infect, get started? Or are they still kind of going for the quick hit, kind of like charge you $5 and then you notice and you turn it off?
Well, for example, in this case, you would notice that the application didn't do anything useful. So that's a pretty obvious clue for people that something's wrong. But that's pretty much the only clue, because you wouldn't be able to tell that it's sending messages. You would see it by the time you get your next phone bill, or if you have a prepaid phone, by the time they shut down your phone because you've overcharged it. So they can be quite stealthy. And, of course, we will be probably seeing more and more advanced attacks and things like mobile phone rootkits or mobile phone botnets.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about. What, you know, when's the first zombie network built of all cell phones going to happen?
That's something we've been thinking about. And you want to hear my guess?
Sure.
I think the logic and the reason why we will be seeing the first mobile phone botnets will be around mobile phone spam, which isn't a big problem right now. Mobile phone spam is a problem in, for example, in some parts of Asia, like Southeast Asia, countries like Malaysia and Indonesia and Philippines. People complain about mobile phone ads being delivered via text messages or Bluetooth beaming in mass scale. But otherwise, pretty much globally, it really isn't a big issue. And the reason, of course, when you compare mobile phone spam and email spam, is that email is totally free. You pay nothing, especially if you hijack somebody else's machine to send the emails for you. You don't even pay for the electricity. It's totally free. So you can send as much as you want, you know, billions and billions, no problem. Text messages are cheap, but you still have to pay something. So you can't send them out, you know, in unlimited quantities unless you use somebody else's phone to do it.
Exactly. Yeah, so, I remember back in the early days of SMS, my brother used to actually have to pay 50 cents every time he got a message. So I would send him a message and say, this message cost you 50 cents. And then, you know, then he would call me up and yell at me for. Fortunately, that model
ever to be charged for receiving a message.
It didn't last very long, did it?
yeah, exactly. But of course, this could be claimed that it could lead to a situation where somebody is, for example, distributing a cool game that all the kids will download and install on their phone, and the game has a hidden functionality which would, you know, later on a later date, connect all those phones, let's say 10,000 or 100,000 phones, to a central website where they get instructions. Now they could start in the middle of the night going through the address books of the phones, sending Viagra MMS ads to every single one of those address books, which would nicely, first of all, move the charges away from the real spammer to the innocent bystanders who got infected. Second of all, would hide the real party behind the ads. And third of all, would nicely give the target address list. No, they would know who to send the spam to because they could simply look at the address books or the contact lists of all the infected phones. Could happen.
It could. I think it'll happen one of these years too. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah. But exactly when, I won't be able to guess that. It's been really hard to estimate the development so far. I before we saw the very first mobile phone viruses, and we were like having these brainstorming sessions and thinking about what they will look like. We were pretty wrong. We were thinking about the most typical first mobile phone viruses would be simple ports of existing Win32 viruses. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen that at all.
Advent of Windows Mobile, you haven't seen that.
Yeah, we have seen some cases of Windows Mobile malware, but they've been unique, written from scratch. Nobody's taken the existing source code of some common Windows XP email worm and ported it to Windows Mobile, which is frankly surprising, but yeah, that's just the way it is.
So the iPhone has to be one of the most intensely studied closed systems, and as we know, iPhone hacks are really hot right now.
Absolutely.
Do you think it's a bad idea to have a closed system like that?
Well, I can see why they did it, and of course they're free to do it, but it's not going to last for long. It will just, because there's been so much hype, and we've seen just how much interest there is at the device, and because it's closed in the sense of that you can't just, you know, pick your operator. Obviously, there's going to be massive motivation behind the hackers to break the thing. And once they are, while they are doing that, they will uncover all sorts of other nasty things. And we have to remember, this is 1.0. This is the first attempt from Apple at this thing. Do you think it's bug-free? Do you think it's perfect? I don't think so. There will be issues. And of course, there has been issues already. So I think the likelihood of some sort of malware or some sort of self-replicating code appearing as a result to the iPhone device, I think that's quite likely. I'd say there's a 90% chance we'll see it sooner or later.
First, we need a compiler that targets it, so it's coming up soon.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the amount of these devices, the iPhone cells are pretty nice, so the needed installed base is there for somebody who wants to infect large amount of devices.
So one of the important lessons that I learned when I was working on exploiting online games was the risk posed by fat clients, you know, clients that control lots and lots of state in a distributed system that operate outside of trust boundaries. So I think that the cell phone is beginning to look an awful lot like that. these days.
Yeah, tell me about it. My cell phone here that I'm having in my other hand is it's an E90 communicator, which has 300 megahertz processor. It has 8 gigs of storage space. It has Quake. I have both Doom 2 and Quake ported on these things, and they all run, you know, at nice 20 frames a second. It has 800 by almost 400 pixel resolution. If you just look at the facts of this device, this is very close to a laptop you would buy perhaps 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it has, you know, all the office applications, everything you would think that a normal computer would have. So it's definitely a very fat application, and the amount of attack vectors, because there's so many different ways of moving data to and from this device, is just mind-boggling. So absolutely, all that applies.
That, and I also think that people are beginning to write applications in a way where they crack a piece of the application off and hand it over to the client to actually execute. Now, if you think about service-oriented architecture or this whole Web 2.0 hype stuff, mm-hmm. which is really just client-server warmed over, but done in a massive way, then you can see that, you know, we're building systems that are going to have really interesting new problems.
Absolutely. And plus all these different scripting platforms that are built into different systems that are basically just another facet of the same thing.
So you and I both began computing early through video games. I'm thinking something like Intellivision, which I see that you own one of, and PCs, and Apple II for me. I don't know which PC you had first.
I had a Commodore 64.
There you go. Well, that's too bad. That explains a lot. So so how did you get started in computer security?
I suppose it really starts in a way from the Commodore 64, because I used to write programs. I even was selling my programs for Commodore 64 as a teenager, you know, disk turbo loaders and different kind of applications I used to write. And of course, to get any kind of performance out of those 1 megahertz machines, you had to write in assembly. So
right.
I was spending quite a bit of time writing large programs in assembly. So I had the assembly skills. And then many years, well, not many, but like say 5 years later, when I had graduated and was looking for a job, I went to this company and I started writing database applications and different sort of high-end development. And the company turned out to be Data Fellows, which is the same company I'm still working today. We later renamed ourselves to F-Secure.
Right.
Because in the early days, we did lots of things. I mean, really, I was writing database applications for some sort of factory development systems when I started. But when we started to move more and more of our attention into data security and into viruses, which at the time were spreading on floppy disks instead of the internet.
Yes, the old sneaker net. I remember.
Oh, yes. Well, the problem was, in order to analyze those viruses, which were written in assembly, you had to be able to read assembly. And I was pretty much the only guy in the company who had lots of skills in assembly when we started getting the very first virus samples in. So, of course, they were handed to me. Now, as you know, assembly language, 8-bit and assembly language, you know, the 16-bit assembly language of DOS that we were working with, the first DOS viruses, is quite different, but then again, not that different. So I moved from one assembly to another and started cracking viruses, which back then, this was 1991, I guess. Yeah, 1991, you know, or perhaps early 1992. So I basically had these long interrupt lists printed on papers and different reference books for memory maps of MS-DOS 3.3, and trying to figure out how these huge viruses would work, and huge would be like 700-byte virus, or was the big one.
Isn't that funny?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, even didn't have, in the early days, enough money to get an extra PC, which I could just infect, you know, to see what it does.
Right.
Just, you know, look at the code and figure out what it does, and then maybe 6-7 months later, we actually, you know, we're selling enough security solutions we could actually buy an extra computer just to infect it.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah. So, quite different today, I'm telling you.
Oh, it is. You know, a lot of people have sort of lost track of what actually happens on computers, unfortunately. So
yeah,
they think of that stuff way down there. Actually, they don't think of that stuff way down there.
No, why would they think about it? They see, you know, they see what's on screen and they think that's it.
Yep. So you have a huge assortment of arcade games and game consoles from the ancient days at home.
Well, these are the only good things. I don't play anything on the PC. I don't think PC is for playing. I think PC is for work. When you want to play, you take preferably take something you can put a coin in and then start playing.
So what's your favorite game?
Xevious. That's the Namco-made, Atari-licensed space shooter from 1982.
Wow, I don't know that one.
It's a great one. It's the Xevious with X. You can look it up from Wikipedia. I'm sure you've seen it. Raiden and many other space shooters look very similar, but this is the original. And it's you know, filled with different secrets and riddles and hidden parts. I have the damn thing here in my basement, and I still haven't found all the secrets they've put in there.
That's hilarious.
Oh, yeah. It's a great game.
So you also have a band called the FSMCs, or FSMCs. I guess you call it the Management Consoles, huh?
That's correct. FSMCs in the house.
And you produce inscrutable Finnish hip-hop, as far as I
can. Yeah, surprisingly, Finnish is a language perfectly suited for hip-hop, believe it or not. You know, it is
because
a weird language,
it's so inscrutable.
The words are very long, but it just somehow works.
So this morning I listened to one of your songs, which I'm going to try to pronounce. It was Beleiden Pelastajat or something like that.
Yeah, that's Beleiden Pelastajat. That's the guys who come to the party, which is slowing down, and they save it.
Excellent. Who knew that there were two words in that in Finnish for that? So, yeah. are there more CDs in the works from your band?
Yeah, of course. But you know, we're not about to quit our day job, so don't worry about that.
Well, everybody will have to go check out your music. Well, thanks. This has been fun.
All right, Gary. Take care.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, where excerpts are published in every issue. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.